The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for Monday the 1st of September. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up, bad science, and no, we're not talking about a particularly ropey previous podcast of ours. We're speaking to author and Dr. Ben Goldacre about all things quackery, including his reaction to the scrapping of a university homeopathy degree.
It's not science. The science is to do with distinguishing between things that are truth and things that are false. And in most cases where these things are investigated thoroughly, they turn out to be false.
Also in the podcast, a man who Queen guitarist Brian May says rocks. Marcus Chown joins us in the pod to discuss quantum physics and relativity theory. Plus, why the world is getting happier.
Unhappiness is the gap between what you expect to have in life and what you actually do have.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Well, it's all smiles in the studio today. Joining me in the pod are usual suspects, Guardian Science correspondent James Randerson. James, are you happy?
I am, yeah. I'm about to go on holiday.
Excellent. And for our very own Nell Bowes, Nell, what makes you grin like a Cheshire cat?
Butter, normally, among other things. I don't know. What do
and
you
cakes,
say?
And cakes. Also here is astronomer and cosmologist Marcus Chown. Marcus, have you met Brian May?
I have, yes.
And he does say you rock. Is that true?
Yeah. In fact, he very kindly read the manuscripts of the book we're going to talk about. Well, and he's, you know, he had very good editing comments.
Well, good. Well, we've met him as well. You know, he even did us a jingle, which is going to make a return for 1 week only. And also, Ben Goldacre's here. Ben, glad you could finally make it after 2.5 years.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Feel free to chip in, everyone, but I'll start this week's programme with you. Ben, your book finally is been published. There's a copy of it actually here on the desk in front of us. But, you know, better late than never. It's being serialised in The Guardian. Tell us a bit about the themes you're going to cover. It's not just a collection of columns from the last 5 years. You've been doing bad science for that long now. So what was the sort of driver behind this?
I guess, I mean, mainly it's a popular science book about epidemiology and evidence-based medicine. And I can see you all look very excited by that. Which it astonishes me that nobody's ever written one before. If you look at all of the science coverage in national mainstream newspapers, you find that about half of it is about health. And most of that is about the evidence on what will kill or cure you. You know, the Daily Mail's kind of ongoing Sisyphean mythical task of dividing all the inanimate objects in the world, really, into the ones that will either cause or cure cancer. So this is something that people are very interested in. But there's never once been in the Science Museum an exhibit about evidence-based medicine, despite the fact that it's the applied science that's probably saved more lives in the past 50 years than any other. It's not taught in schools. And that struck me as being an extraordinary disparity that leaves the field open for a lot of very misleading claims to be made.
And it's a confusing world. I mean, there's statistics in there, there's all sorts of claim and counterclaim, which is the seam that you've been mining in the column for a few years.
Yeah, but actually, I mean, what's really useful about quackery as a way of teaching evidence-based medicine is that the errors that they make are very simple and straightforward. So the book, I like to fantasise, follows a kind of natural crescendo where we start off looking at how the evidence on homeopathy has been distorted and misrepresented and how you do a trial, because obviously homeopathy is basically the perfect teaching case for doing a randomised control trial. It is a pill that seems to perform better than a sugar pill, and the whole process of critically appraising scientific literature in medicine is all about trying not to get caught out and making that error. And then we sort of go up through the nutrition and the $50 billion food supplement pill industry until we're ready to take on the $600 billion pharmaceutical industry, which gets a pretty round kicking. I'm very pleased to be able
we kind of go on ad nauseum in this podcast and in pieces we write too about homeopathy and in our blogs, we get quite good responses about, you know, to point out that, you know, that there's no evidence base and so on and so on. But what is it that you've talked about in this book? I mean, what is it you've added to that? Are you trying to explain to people how a medicine gets approved effectively, how it's proved to work? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, to me, homeopathy is only really a teaching device. I mean, you've got to think about why homeopathy is interesting. And
the reason I ask that is because you can kind of imagine, well, look, it's an easy target, isn't it, homeopathy?
Yeah. I mean, the whole purpose of talking about homeopathy is because, as I said, it's a good, clean teaching case for learning about evidence-based medicine. And it's the perfect opportunity because you'll find homeopaths quoting trials which have really basic flaws, things like, you know, no blinding or inadequate randomization. You also see them sort of misquoting and misrepresenting meta-analyses and systematic reviews of scientific literature. And it's, you know, it's the perfect way to talk about that. And obviously, homeopaths also make themselves funny by behaving very badly when their ideas are questioned. And that makes them funny, which is a sweetener on the cake. But really, you know, it's a way of getting from A to B to me. I mean, in my kind of day job, I do things like, you know, teach medical students and doctors about critically appraising clinical trial methodology or drug company bullshit, as I was delighted to see my lecture was actually called in the UCL timetable recently. And I think it's important to be able to take the really kind of difficult ideas of critically appraising pharmaceutical trial methodology, where they're trying to kind of bluff and pull the wool over the eyes of doctors who are trained and taught to spot methodological flaws in scientific evidence and claims that are being made to them. I think it's really important to be able to translate some of that into everyday lay language. And that's only doable if you start off with an easy example. And you know, homeopathy is that.
Well, the people on the pod here are itching to ask questions, but I'm going to just ask one more quickly before opening it up. You've got homeopathy there, but can you just run us through a couple of the other examples in the book, maybe one or two other ones that we can maybe end up talking about?
Yeah, well, I do The Truth About Nutritionists, which I think is a very important one because, I mean, there's no doubt that food has become the kind of bollocks du jour, if I'm allowed to. Is this an adult audience?
Please, swear all you like.
Really? Can I act properly? No, I always think it sounds rather crass. The whole story of sort of how nutrition has become the bollocks du jour, and that's a sort of slightly more sophisticated way that they misrepresent evidence. But there's also a lot about kind of looking at why these dodgy ideas are so seductive. So, I mean, there's a huge chunk on the placebo effect going through all of the most recent evidence looking at that, but also stuff on sort of cognitive biases and the psychological research into irrational beliefs, which I think is also very interesting because that's the reason why you do statistics. That's the reason why you study things systematically, is because you want to avoid being caught out by the kind of biases inherent in intuition.
You want to take the human being out of it, essentially.
No. I mean, what's interesting about looking at irrationality from a kind of research perspective is you realise that intuition is actually very valuable for questions in something like the social domain. You know, should I trust this business partner? You know, is this somebody I want to shack up with and have babies with? But it's very, very bad for deciding whether MMR causes autism, for example. Especially when, as I demonstrate in my painfully lengthy and detailed chapter, people never stood a chance making an intuitive judgment call on MMR and autism because the media deliberately and unanimously distorted the experimental evidence on it in what can only be a very cynical and deliberate way.
Well, we're going to come back to you a bit later in the programme when we look at some uncomplimentary comments that have led to the suspension of a degree in complementary medicine.
I maintain, actually, that I'm defending them. I'm defending their academic reputation for them. Their vice-chancellor doesn't seem to be capable of doing it for himself, so I'm doing it for him. That's my view of the matter, not, I dare say, his.
Before that, here are some of the other stories making waves in science over the last week. Here's Nell and James with your News Jam.
News Jam. Children who receive a rich variety of home learning before they start school achieve better results in maths tests at age 10, according to a major government-funded study into childhood learning. The researchers said the benefits of reading to a child, playing with numbers and shapes, teaching them nursery rhymes and taking them to the library are detectable on top of the influence of their parents' wealth and level of education.
Despite deepening economic gloom and impending climatic destruction, the world is becoming a happier place. That's according to an analysis of a quarter of a century of data on well-being from 45 countries around the globe. The finding goes against the received wisdom that a country's economic advances do not translate into increased well-being amongst its citizens.
Steam power could be about to make a comeback thanks to a company that's trying to make the internal combustion engine more efficient. Clean Power Technologies is developing steam hybrid engines that claw back some of the immense amount of energy wasted. Their first step will be a refrigerator truck that runs its cooling system upon waste heat from the main engine. Ultimately, they aim to develop a car that runs partly on steam power.
And finally, scientists using a high-speed video have revealed why swatting flies is so difficult. The insects take just 200 milliseconds to adjust their stance to an impending threat before launching themselves in the right direction to avoid it. If you want to squash a fly, they say, your best bet is to aim just in front of where it is.
Nell, James, thank you very much. Personally, I thought that the best way to swat a fly was to catch it in chopsticks like Mr. Miyagi does. Right, tell me a bit more about these stories, James. Preschool learning, this idea that doing all these extra things can help your child.
This is a very detailed, long-term study looking at children from age 3. Now they're up to age 10. I think it will carry on all the way to age 14. And the researchers have got lots of detailed data on socioeconomic background, the home environment, the sort of things that parents do with their kids, the kind of preschool education they had, the kind of primary school education they had. And the interesting thing about it is that they've found that the influence of some of these factors before the child ever goes to school is still there at age 10 in the scores that they get in maths and in other subjects too. In particular, preschool is quite important, the sort of nursery you go to, having quality nursery education. One thing that came out, really shone through for me, that I found quite kind of heartening, is as a parent, if you're it does matter whether you have how highly educated you are and how rich you are. Both of those things have an influence on your childhood's on your child's attainment. But despite those things, even if you are from a St. Council estate and you got one GCSE, what you do with your child still matters. So if you read to them, if you teach them nursery rhymes, if you take them to the library, that still makes a difference. So it's not just about kind of middle class kids being read to, and that's all that matters. You know, you can kind of tease out these different effects.
Happiness. This is a story that comes up time and time again, and we're always told that in surveys of happiness over the decades, however rich people get, however how much development there is in a country, no one gets happier, actually, because our relative desires, I suppose, ratchet up just with everything else. But this study is saying almost the opposite. We've spoken to the author of the happiness paper, Roberto Foa, at Harvard University. The quality of the phone line might make some listeners sad, so apologies for that in advance.
Unhappiness is the gap between what you expect to have in life and what you actually do have. Throughout human history, there have always been, I would say, two strategies for maximizing your happiness. One of those is to bring your expectations into line with reality, with what you do have, to achieve a kind of contentment. And sort of the classic strategies for doing that are through spirituality, through your religious life, and through your family, through your community ties. The other strategy, if you will, is to expand the freedoms that you have, the economic freedom, the political freedom, the social freedoms that you have. Now, there are a number of societies that have done better in that first strategy, and I think the societies of Latin America certainly are societies that stand out in that regard, that have stronger family lives, have stronger community lives, and where people have attained a level of happiness that is above what you would expect simply as a result of their economic development, which, if you will, is that part of that second strategy. It's really a case of diminishing returns, that beyond a certain threshold, economic gains don't give you returns for your happiness.
Ben, these two last stories are classic examples of excellent social science. Social science must be a seam of terrible stories for you, or do you just sort of stay away from easy targets like that, do you think?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, they're always really attractive, and I think there's so much mutually contradictory social science research out there that you just select the ones that reinforce your own prejudices. The one that you were talking about there about people getting, you know, whether people get happier or not as they get richer. The one that I remember, and I don't even know if it's like a false memory of an imaginary piece of social science research, but I'm sure that I can remember hearing that Gini score is correlated very significantly with happiness. Gini coefficient is the measure of the amount of income inequality in a country. And so, you know, the more income inequality is, the more acquisitive crime there is in the country, the more violence there is, the more people beat their wives up and all that kind of horrible stuff. And I have a vague memory that more social inequality means more misery. But at the same time, I don't know if that's just stuck in my head because I think that social inequality is a really bad thing.
I just don't believe you can possibly define happiness. I mean, how do they ever do this?
What are the questions that they
ask? I bet it's a very simple questionnaire which can't possibly... I mean, what does happiness mean?
Well, it's a very good question philosophically, but I think, crucially, whatever they're measuring here is the same thing from year to year, because they're asking the same questions. I mean, the classic problem with these kind of studies is that you compare your data from 2000 with your data from 1990 when you ask slightly different questions, and you can never be sure, is the change in the percentages to do with a change in the way we ask the questions or whatever. So, yeah, I take your point that exactly what you're measuring here is hard to know, but... You know, they're asking things like, how satisfied are you with your life?
Your happiness, you know, happiness is like, it comes in bursts. I mean, you know, you're happy for like, you know, have a cup of coffee, I'm happy, you know. I mean, surely it depends when you get asked this questionnaire.
And presumably the questions in the questionnaire, like, change in relation to the social context over the last 30 years. Like, the idea of satisfaction in your life, how satisfied are you, has changed in the past 30 years as something you ought to be kind of attaining or not.
So does anybody know, like, a really good social science primer that we could read? Because actually, I've just realised I'd like to know about social... There must be a standard...
Listen to Thinking Aloud.
Someone send me an email.
Laurie Taylor does an excellent job of social sciences, I think. He minds this seem very, very well.
But you see, I think the problem is always getting things in sort of bits and bobs like you do in newspapers is actually a very unsatisfactory way to learn about a new discipline. If anybody, honestly, if anybody knows of a good social science textbook, email me.
You can email bad.science. Or you can have your say on all of this stuff at guardian.co.uk/science/blog. Or post something on the Facebook wall. If you're not a member of our group, search for I Listen to the Guardian Science Podcast.
Hi folks, this is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly
from guardian.co.uk.
Now let's peer through the diffraction gauze into our online scientific community and find out what you've been saying. Last week's News Jam special appears to have been largely ignored on our Facebook wall. Damn you all. Instead, you're still waxing lyrical about the Science of Music special from the week before. But on our new style blog pages, after last week's show and on the subject of flying saucers, Freedom Land says, China has had them for years and has kindly given us some links to see them in action. So thanks for that, Freedom Land. Outset says give Harun Yahya's creationist ideas a chance. And the blog on Yahya's challenge to Richard Dawkins is by far and away the most commented on. On a similar theme, our blog entitled Dawkins and the Fart of God, and that's one of James's posts, which is about some offensive emails he gets, Beeline 32 says, it's very rare to see Dawkins laughing, and it actually has quite a profound effect on his appearance. He should do it more, and possibly read out some of the more abusive emails too. Hilarious. You can all take part at guardian.co.uk/science/blogs.
Science Weekly.
Time for a proper and more formal Science Weekly welcome to Marcus Chown. Marcus is a former radio astronomer at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena and now cosmology consultant at New Scientist. His new book, which on some websites is eligible for free Super Express delivery if you order within the next 4 minutes, is called Quantum Theory Cannot Hurt You. Marcus, thank you very much for coming in. Quantum physics can't hurt you. Who thought it can hurt you? People, is it as a mental hurt, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's got this aura. Quantum theory is our description of the microscopic world of atoms, so the constituents of you and me and everybody. And it's been fantastically productive. You know, it's given us computers and lasers and nuclear reactors and iPod nanos, and it tells us why this table here is solid, why the sun shines. But it also, apart from being, I think it was something like 70% of the GDP of America is apparently based on inventions which are based on quantum theory. But besides being enormously practical, a recipe for building things, it gives us an insight into an incredible Alice in Wonderland world, which underpins the everyday world, a world where an atom can be in two places at once, you know, where atoms on different sides of the universe can communicate with each other instantaneously, where things happen for no reason at all. My idea in writing this book was really to you know, there's this fantastic development that you know, made the everyday world, and it's completely bypassed the everyday person in the street, and they're fearful of it. And I wanted to tell them that really there's no reason to be fearful, and this can be understood by anybody.
They're fearful, I think, because it's so weird. I mean, quantum mechanics just has no it's intuitively strange. It makes no sense.
That's the excitement.
Can I say if you think you understand it, you don't?
Yeah, well, that's the...
Well, these statements, which are made by physicists, and I do think that even Richard Feynman made statements like that, are really doing the public a disservice. You know, I mean, you know, they're trying to say, we're the experts, we're the priesthood, we understand it, it's beyond you. This is complete rubbish.
Okay, in your slim volume then, by the way, which is slimmer than Ben's book, so, you know, quantum physics explained in half the time that Ben takes.
Less than 200 pages.
Evidence-based medicine. But tell us, you mentioned just now the certain proportion of the world's GDP is based on quantum physics. Just go rattle through some examples for us of the kinds of things that quantum physics has done for us, to quote Monty Python.
Well, absolutely everything. As I mentioned, things like lasers, computers, nuclear reactors, none of these things would be possible without an understanding of quantum theory. You know, and it does come down to, you know, the solidity of matter, you know, the ground that you stand on, the reason that the sun shines. Absolutely everything is explained by quantum. So there's this fantastic theory which has been devised, which is probably the most successful in the history of the human race, and yet the average person in the street is completely bypassed them. So this is an attempt by me to get people up to speed, you know, quite quickly. Half the book is actually about relativity, the other development in the last 100 years.
Well, I was going to say that not only have you managed to talk about quantum physics in this book, but in the other 100 pages it's about the other very hard physics bit thing, relativity. We'll come back to relativity in a minute, but Pod, any quick questions on quantum mechanics that you need answering?
Well, you managed to explain it in less than 200 pages. I was wondering, can you give us a précis in a couple of sentences?
Well, I mean, I always think to myself, these ideas have been accreted over a long period of time, like a patchwork. And nobody's gone back and thought, well, you know, if you wanted to explain quantum theory or relativity to anyone, you know, what is the one thing that you need to actually tell people from which everything else follows? You know, with relativity, it's simply that a light ray is uncatchable. Absolutely everything follows from that. You know, the fact that actually time and intervals of time and intervals of space are not the same for everyone. You know, time is kind of stretchy and so is space, you know. So in other words, if you travel near the speed of light, you shrink in the direction of motion like a pancake. Your time slows down. With quantum theory, the one thing from which most of it follows is simply that the building blocks of matter, atoms or whatever, are simultaneously localized particles like billiard balls and spread out waves like waves on a pond. Now that is virtually impossible to get your head around, but it's because they have these two almost contradictory aspects that leads to all the other phenomena. And one of the things that is so amazing about quantum theory, why should you be interested? Not only does it explain the everyday world, But it really does tell us about this world, which is far stranger than science fiction. I once interviewed the American astronomer Carl Sagan, and he'd written a science fiction novel, Contact. You know, it was made into a film with Jodie Foster. And he also did science. And I said, you know, why do you do science rather than science fiction? And he said, because science is stranger than science fiction. And when you learn about quantum theory, when you learn that an atom can actually be in two places at once, the equivalent of you being in London and New York at the same time, you know, you just can't get your head around it. Did you know that an electron is not the same electron if it's rotated once through 360 degrees? You have to rotate it through 720 degrees, two turns, before it's the same electron.
The Large Hadron Collider is going to switch on in just under 2 weeks now, you know, we'll be reporting on that as and when. But
well,
what's exciting?
If we don't all die.
If we don't.
But then the guys who are suing the Large Hadron Collider will get loads of money.
Well, they will. The money will mean.
Why are we going to die?
Money will mean nothing.
There's a bunch of conspiracy theorists who are trying to protest against them doing it.
Let's not worry about the black hole problem. We've tackled
this
before.
All I would say is that there are particles coming through, you know, the atmosphere, coming through this room, which are, you know, a million times more energetic than anything that we will be able to create. And they're involved in collisions in the upper atmosphere. And if anything was going to be triggered,
seriously, man, be careful what you say, because you can really freak people out with that.
I think one.
So we know.
I think one just hit Ben in the head just now. But I was going to say, with the Large Hadron Collider, we're going to get to energies which we've never reached before on Earth, in very small amounts, admittedly. What that's going towards, though, is tackling this massive problem that sort of sits in the middle of physics like a big white elephant, which is that relativity theory, very, very successful, genius. Einstein came up with it. Quantum physics people came up with it over 20 or 30 years, the beginning of the 20th century as well. Obviously, you said it's very successful. They don't agree with each other. And Yeah. What are we going to do about it? Do you have a crack at tackling that in the book?
Well, essentially, as you say, quantum theory is a theory of the very small, you know, of atoms and their constituents. Einstein's theory of general relativity is a theory of gravity, and gravity only is such a weak force that it's only significant when you get really big masses. So it's a theory of the very big. And so at the moment, we the domains of the very small and very big don't overlap. But we do know that the universe emerged from, you know, a very compressed state, the Big Bang, when it was the whole universe, a big thing, was very small. So we do need to unite those two theories if we ever want to understand the origin of the universe. The Large Hadron Collider is not going to get anywhere near the energies, you know, by some fantastic factor to tell us anything about what you're talking about, which is quantum gravity. That's the holy grail. We're always talking about holy grails, but it's really the holy grail for physics, really.
That's it.
We're not going to get there. No one really knows how to do this. The energy's available to try and figure out. All we can do is the energies at which gravity was quantum, those two theories were unified, they occurred in the Big Bang. So it is possible that we still live, you know, we live in a universe that arose from the Big Bang, that there might be some fossil imprint in the universe, for instance, in the distribution of galaxies or something like that. That's our only hope of discovering something really experimentally about quantum gravity. The Large Hadron Collider falls far short of being able to do that.
But it's still very exciting. And listen in a couple of weeks for all that stuff. Look, at the risk of splitting everyone's heads with this stuff, we'll stop that there for now. Marcus, thanks very much.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
And in the final part of this week's show, developments on the homeopathy front after the University of Central Lancashire suspended its course on it. The degree in homeopathic medicine has stopped recruiting new students after relentless attacks from the Anti-Homeopathy League. One of those being blamed for all the bad press is Professor David Colquhoun, a pharmacologist at University College London. We asked him why homeopathy was such a bad thing.
Because it's not science. I've got no objection to it being taught as anthropology or cultural history or history of medicine. Very interesting topic. I mean, it's a fascinating topic, actually, why so many believe things which turn out, when properly investigated, not to be true. But you can't, it's not science. The science is to do with distinguishing between things that are true and things that are false. And in most cases where these things are investigated thoroughly, they turn out to be false. Universities will say, but they have proper physiology and pharmacology as well. But if you put to them a critical point, you get no answer. And the critical point is that, apropos of homeopathy, for example, the lectures on physiology and biochemistry will tell them that the bigger the dose you give, the larger the effect will be, by and large. Whereas the lectures on homeopathy on the other days will tell them exactly the opposite. Well, which are they to believe? it's rather ludicrous to combine lectures on scientific and non-scientific topics when they're going to contradict each other. And of course, they're required in the end to believe the homeopathic one, because these are not pure science degrees, they're vocational degrees. They boast about how you can get immediate employment as a homeopath. So they've got to believe the junk ones.
Professor David Colquhoun from University College London there. Ben, you're a big fan of David's. He's a lovely man.
One of the funniest men I know.
He's also, his blog, dcscience.net, is a great sort of source of anti-homeopathy stuff. I mean, essentially, we don't want to make you talk about homeopathy the whole time you're here.
Please.
But you must be pleased that this university is not doing a BSc in homeopathic medicine now.
I think that is infinitely, infinitely more important than the question of whether homeopathy should be on the NHS. I think, I mean, this might be the sort of pragmatism of somebody who's sort of practiced medicine more recently than some of the people who campaign viciously against homeopathy. But I don't object so much to homeopathy on the NHS, but people being taught that cherry-picking, that quoting inept, methodologically inadequate trials and all of the rest is an appropriate way to get a BSc, a science degree. I mean, it annoys me so much I can barely construct a sentence.
All right, well, we'll construct a sentence in response to this next question in that case, a completely separate subject. I mean, your book, as you said, it's all about this sort of quackery stuff, but also in your sort of articles and your speeches and lectures and things...
I mean, very little of it is about quackery, actually.
Well,
the majority.
I was going to say that in the last few years, another thesis has sort of been emerging in the kind of the lectures and things you've been giving, which is the relationship between how science is covered in the media, basically, science and the media. And you know, you write in the media, so you know this is a sort of a slightly inward-looking thing. But you hinted at this earlier, you and you've said this before, but you believe that science shouldn't be covered in news. Now, why is that?
I think that science naturally is a much better subject for the feature section of a newspaper, because firstly, the kinds of things that make a science story newsworthy are also the things that make it a little bit more likely to be wrong. You know, it's a new piece of information that's transgressive. It's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily fit with previous findings. That's what makes it newsworthy, but that's also what makes it more likely to be subsequently turn out to be untrue. So I think, firstly, it misrepresents science by suggesting that science is all about very fragile new breakthroughs. But also, more importantly, the way that science moves forward is by the gradual emergence of new themes supported by a raft of evidence in a number of different disciplines. And so that's a feature subject. That's not a new subject about a single experiment that has a new result.
So does that mean that, the argument you just put forward is it kind of probably makes sense for things like medical stories, you know, if I'm playing devil's advocate.
Probably for basic science more,
but
actually.
What about all the other sort of stories that are covered more generally, things like about dinosaurs or space or all that kind of stuff? If people just want to know about, say, the Large Hadron Collider, we're going to tell them about the way the particle physics experiments there are going to work. Would you chuck out all of that?
No,
from the news sections.
No, of course not.
But are you talking about a subset of news?
I think it's a major tragedy that there's no science features in The Guardian anymore. I mean, I think that's a real... Given that we've got... I mean, without wanting to sort of massage you all under the table, we do have a very, very, very... Sorry, that was quite rude. A very strong group of science writers at The Guardian.
There's no massaging going on here, trust me.
Everybody's looking a bit stern and worried now. Obviously, you need a balance. But actually, I think, you know, developments in molecular biology or you know, developments in all kinds of theoretical fields are much better covered as features. And actually, a sudden breakthrough in a treatment, you know, a large clinical trial which has a very significant result, or better still, a systematic review or a meta-analysis that has a large significant result, probably is one of the few things I would count as being newsworthy rather than feature worthy. But I'm biased. I mean, I find it difficult to understand the point of news in general. I mean, the sort of daily ebb and flow of sort of little updates about what's happening in the Middle East to me isn't as interesting as what's, you know, at the end of the year. You know,
we'll get you into a fight with our news editor later. James.
Well, as you might expect, I have to say I completely disagree that you shouldn't put science in the news pages of a newspaper. I mean, it seems to me an absurd suggestion, because I agree with you to the extent that, we should have more science features, and writing about science in a longer form is good because it gives you certain advantages that you don't have in a news context. But what you're advocating is taking out a massive source of information about science from people who would never see it otherwise. So the entire population would be denuded of information about science and what's going on in science. Apart from the fact that a lot of them might be very interested in it, they've paid for it, by and large, mostly, and they have a right to know about it. You're right that there is a certain proportion of stories that are badly reported. But I think to attack news coverage in general because of that is a straw man.
I'm not suggesting that there should be no science news reporting, but I think that the sacrifices that are made, more so in other newspapers than in this one, to crowbar a science story into the news format are very, very significant. In a feature, you have the opportunity to expand on things and also talk about background. I mean, one of the biggest problems in communicating science clearly to a motivated lay audience, because that's the problem. It's not the problem isn't that people are clever or stupid, it's just that they're lacking background knowledge and they're lacking interest. The problem with communicating science to a motivated lay audience is usually that they don't have the background knowledge. And I think in news, you've got less of a chance of filling them in on the background than you do in features.
You know, there's a proportion of stories that are bad and I want to get rid of them, but the rest of the stuff is okay because there's good science stuff that can go into news. But, you know, really you're saying that science, I mean, coming back to your point about adding context to a story, you're saying science shouldn't be told in news because you haven't got the space to give someone the background knowledge to understand it. Now, you could say that about any area of human endeavour, I think. You know, I mean, I know next to nothing about economics, but I'm interested in reading economic stories that may or may not influence my life, probably will. And I don't get all the background about economics theory, but I get enough to kind of understand what's going on. And if I want to know more, maybe I'll go and search on the internet and find out more. What's wrong with giving someone a taste of of what's going on in a story without misleading them. I would never defend doing that, of course. But what's wrong with giving them a taste? And, you know, even if you're not able to put 1,000 words of background into, you know, the last 10 years of research.
You see, I have a sense that science gets dumbed down much more significantly than things like economics, sport or literature. I feel jealous.
I think because you're a scientist.
When I read the book pages, I see that people are allowed to write, you know, 4-page-long essays in which the more obscure Russian novelists you can quote, the better a writer everybody thinks you are. When I read the economics pages or the sports pages,
I don't understand them. You're not comparing light with light.
When I read economics and sports news, I don't understand what they're talking about.
Where people are making obscure references to Russian authors, those are features. They're not news stories. When you read about, you know, say, the 2 Titian paintings that are trying to be saved at the moment, everything in those stories would be understandable by a 12-year-old.
My experience of reading things like literature pages and economics news and sports news is that there are undefined terms which are entirely unfamiliar to me, and as unfamiliar to me as the kinds of things that I would think it would be acceptable to put into a science article, but which you would be forced to take out or forced to define.
Marcus, you're a scientist turned writer. Tell us what you, out of this conversation, whose side are you sort of on here? Do you think that news is a terrible medium to communicate scientific ideas? I mean, you mainly write features and books.
I think it is a difficult medium, but we don't live in an ideal world, unfortunately, you know, where there is a lot of space and there's a lot of competition. What appears in science news in newspapers is a lot better than, for instance, what appears on television, where the competition is even greater. You know, and there, if you're at a news meeting, unless you mention, you know, you want to do a physics story or whatever, unless you mention Stephen Hawking, you can forget it. You know, unless you mention some incredible breakthrough with some figure like him, you can forget it. So, I think to some extent, I do think you're absolutely right about the fact that everything is portrayed as a breakthrough. And certainly in particle physics or cosmology or whatever, there are very, very few breakthroughs. It's exactly the same as in medicine. All science is exactly the same.
I was going to actually pick up on your sports references, which is, I'm not sure that you necessarily want to go down that route of thinking that you don't have to explain, of wanting to be able to be like a sports news story in that you've got certain terms that you're not going to bother to explain, whether it's a kind of particular golf shot or whatever it is. I mean, surely we're better than that, and you shouldn't be kind of envious of sport for not being in that league.
So I think that's really interesting because, to my mind, until the internet came along, it was the geeks who were most neglected in popular culture. It was the people who were already kind of interested in science because they'd done a biochemistry degree at Leicester and now worked in senior management at Woolworths. They were the people where there was actually very little in mainstream popular culture for them. I mean, television's obviously dumbed down ridiculously, but also in general print media, unless people went out of their way to seek it out, there was nothing to keep their kind of nerd muscles in tone. And I think it's a shame to dumb everything down to the point where there's not anything to give sort of any kind of substantial nourishment to people with those kinds of interests. I mean, actually now I think the most exciting thing that's happened to public engagement with science is undoubtedly blogging. And I'm speaking at the Nature Science Bloggers Conference, which is going to be brilliant. And actually, the other thing I really noticed is I ran into the guy who does Mind Hacks, which is one of the most fantastic blogs ever, popular sort of psychology stuff, and also the guy who does neurophilosophy. And I ran into him at a conference, and I realised that they were kind of more famous to me than the sort of TV presenter, sciencey people there, because I'd really engaged with their stuff, and also they were telling me things that were really interesting that I didn't know, in a way that Robert Winston, in his endlessly repetitive, dumbed-down programmes, has never, ever done. And I think, actually, that kind of unmediated communication, postdocs communicating in everyday language but to a highly motivated audience who have chosen to seek them out, is actually, you know, it kind of makes any discussion about whether the media can adequately inform and entertain nerds completely irrelevant. You know, when you've got things like Mind Hacks and neurophilosophy and everything on science blogs...
We're meant for, is it, though?
Well, it's nerds care about the most, actually. And I feel that they have been massively neglected, particularly by the kind of self-styled public engagement with science community, you know, the people that we always run into at those parties at the Welcome or whatever. And they're always running, you know, they're telling you about, oh, we've done this great new BMX move and it's called the Einstein stunt and we got the kids in to, you know, divine this manoeuvre and that's really cool because it's going to get everyone interested in Einstein. And here's a ballet with everybody with names of elements from the periodic table painted on their tutus. I mean, it just makes me want to slam my cock in the door. And I think
that... But hold on, that's not really what public engagement with science is about. And what we're not talking about is, I mean, nerds can find their blogs and nerds can find that community, and it's great that community's been growing in the past 5 years or whatever. But what we started off talking about was average news stories in the papers day to day, and that's stuff that all of my English lit friends want to know about and are interested in and aren't going to go onto a nerd site in order to find out about. But we ought to be feeding them that information in some comprehensible way.
That's fine, and Horses for Courses is all very cool, but the nerds were massively neglected by popular culture. And actually, I think newspaper and television let them down really badly. And actually, the only place where really you get good science now, I think, is on Radio 4. And there's an interesting reason for that, and that is, if you listen to a Radio 4 science documentary, 80% of the spoken word content is made up by scientists themselves speaking about either their own work or the field that they work in that they're very familiar in. And that's how you make good... That's how you communicate science properly, by facilitating the people who already know about it to write about it and to talk about it. I actually think that the world needs less science writers and more good editors. We need people who can help people who work in various different difficult fields. We need people who can help them and shepherd them into expressing the kind of work that they do in their own words.
Marcus, do you agree?
No, I don't agree.
Brilliant.
I mean, I listen to those programs on Radio 4, and as somebody who, you know, I listen to a program about cosmology or physics or something, and I will know that a lot of jargon is uttered by those physicists that I understand, but I would guess that the average listener doesn't understand at all.
Okay, what Radio 4 Science show are you talking about?
Well, you know, I mean, things like, I'm trying to remember the programmes, the Melvin Bragg programmes. He tends not to get them to define the things that they're talking about. I think you do need science writers. I'm a science writer, and I talk to people. I'm an interpreter. I talk to people in their language, physicists in their language, and then I try and communicate that to people who don't have any background at all. I mean, my model is my wife, who has no science background. She's a nurse, but she has a medical background, but no physics background. That's the kind of people I talk to, and I think you kind of belittle the skill required in communicating science, and that there are many scientists who have a very profound understanding of the world but can't communicate it. There are science writers who can write very well but don't have any profound understanding, but there are still these people who can create the bridge, and they are worthy.
We'll have to leave that stuff there, I think. This is obviously something that will continue on and on and on. Ben, thanks very much. Thanks very much to this week's guests, Ben Goldacre and Marcus Chown. And thanks also to James and Nell. You can all tell us what you think about anything we discussed today at guardian.co.uk/science/blog. Don't forget our Facebook wall as well. You can also hear the full extended interviews with Ben and Marcus at guardian.co.uk/science. This edition of Science Weekly was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.